You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 23rd of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Gillian Tobias and Emma Nelson.
Coming up on today's programme, a French erotic epic or 3 hours of your life you'll never get back. We review Blue is the Warmest Colour.
De ma liberté et de mes propres valeurs. Tu vois. Et puis aussi son exigence dans l'engagement. J'adhère complètement.
Ouais, c'est un peu comme Bob Marley, quoi.
Ouais.
Presque. We'll also be looking at other films, the casts of which will most definitely have more clothes on.
Including the fully dressed Bernie Cho. He'll bring us the latest from the world of K-pop, including this from a lady who's been in the papers for a scandal involving, you'll guess it, nudity.
Cut the beat now! Wait a minute, wait a minute.
Plus, we'll hear what Mexico City has to offer over the coming days and find out what TV will be on small screens around the world in the months to come. So, lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
Ladies and gentlemen, it appears to be a skin special on The Review this week, but we will try and keep it as discreet and as upstanding as possible. Gillian, how was your cultural week?
Oh, it was wonderful. I dipped back into the ballet. I went to Covent Garden and saw. I was specifically have been trying to see this one dancer who's being hailed as the next big thing. She's an Irish dancer called Melissa Hamilton, and I finally got a chance to see her in a matinee performance of Romeo and Juliet.
And?
Exquisite. But what's interesting about her is she was passionate about ballet, and all through her teens, she was always told, you'll never make it, you'll never make it, you'll be a failure. And then she found a mentor who really believed in her, whisked her away, tutored her privately, and now she's been winning every single Young Dancer Award. And to see her in Juliet, which is a perfect role for someone so young, but just the technique and the emotion, I just think anyone, if you can see Melissa Hamilton, book tickets now.
Melissa Hamilton is the name. Do you get the impression that in about 30, 40 years' time, people will say, did you see the Romeo and Juliet at Covent Garden that launched her?
Oh, I just had goosebumps when you said that, because I hope so. I hope so, because she definitely has the potential. And I'm glad I searched her out, and I do advise it for everyone else. What about you? You were in Paris. I was very jealous.
I was super busy. I have had a belly full of culture this week. I was in Paris last week. Our next guest, Tim Roby, has just come back from Paris as well, so we'll have a little Paris chat in a moment. I was lucky enough to go to Paris Photo. And I'd never been before, and I was incredibly excited about it. I'd been warned that it was just the same as it has been last year, but that really didn't matter to me.
But it's interesting, because Paris Photo, it's kind of like the frieze, what is frieze's for art. This is like for what it
or
is
FIAC.
For yeah. photographs, exactly.
Yeah,
in that
Basel.
It's more like a market
totally.
Than a fair.
I didn't get that feeling, although it was nice to see. It was actually quite nice to see prices on things. It was nice to try and get they were sort of openly putting a value on the market. Whereas if you went to Frieze, half of the time you didn't know what was an exhibit. But it was a wonderfully complete, dare I say it, snapshot of the world's best photography. You had absolutely everything from early 19th century, the first images of anything, right up until, super, super photoshopped images. But what sort of floated to the surface for me were the reportage pictures, which still endure and which still just grab you, and for me are what I think photography is all about, when you capture an image at a point in time in a place that you will preserve forever.
Any favourites?
Yes, the Magnum stand just knocked me sideways. It was Sergio Larrain, the Chilean photographer in the 1960s, did this great reportage on the slums of Valparaiso, and that was just wonderful. And then there was Daniel Blau, the gallery, got for the 100th anniversary of Kappa's birthday, got as many pictures of Kappa as they possibly could. They had a wall of them, and you just got this. You were overwhelmed by Kappa's brilliance, actually, especially the landings where obviously the film had been distorted, and it just sort of really, really just said the brilliant photographers endure. And yeah, there was some modern stuff. And yes, it was very very good in certain parts. There's a great photographer called Joseph Hofflehner who does a delightful series of beach portraits of people standing on a beach, but it's in St. Martin's where the planes all land. And one thing that astonished me, everybody was taking photographs of the photographs. It was just odd.
It's our world, though, isn't it? Everyone's taking photographs of everything. You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24.
Now, it's a graphic adaptation of a graphic novel about a teenage girl's lesbian love affair. Blue is the Warmest Colour won this year's Palme d'Or at Cannes for its director Abdelatif Kechiche, but he had to share it with his two lead actors, Adèle Exarchopoulos and Léa Seydoux.
The film has attracted notoriety, not least for its lengthy, highly explicit sex scenes, but also for accusations from both leading women that the director made tyrannical demands on them during filming. We touched on the controversy following its Palme d'Or win at Cannes back in May, but we raise the curtain a little bit more now as Blue is the Warmest Colour is making its ways from the festival circuit to cinema screens near you.
Here to discuss it and some of the week's other releases, I'm delighted to say that the film critic Tim Robey has come in to talk to us. But let's start with Blue is the Warmest Colour. Welcome, by the way, Tim. That was very rude of me. Simply because Blue is the Warmest Colour, it lasts 3 hours. It leaves quite an imprint on one, doesn't it?
It really does, yeah. This is a film that has excited a lot of people in a lot of different ways. Some of them a bit dubious. Some of them very high-minded. You know, the Cannes jury obviously really sprung for it. And some of them on a more sort of tabloid level, there's been the scandal about the fallout between the director and his two leading ladies, who now have refused to work with him ever again. I think it's a very, very worthwhile and genuine and enthralling piece of art. But
What's the premise? I mean, we briefly mentioned that it is the story of a girl's lesbian sexual awakening.
Yeah, that's a fair enough assessment, certainly of the first half, though, I would say. So basically, we begin with her at the end of school. She's a high school student. She's sort of putting her feet tentatively into the waters of dating. This guy asks her out. She kind of goes out with him as a bit of an experiment. Doesn't really pan out. And then there's this moment when she's crossing a street in Paris and she sees her future lover, played by Léa Seydoux, who's this blue-haired art student. And it's like her sort of world stops, and she stops in her tracks. She literally spins around in the traffic, and it's a sort of moment when she realizes where her kind of her desires lie and what's going to make her happy.
This is a film almost that could only have been made in France. There is so much cerebral philosophizing and themes in the films. I wonder if you can talk about some of the recurring themes and layers of meaning behind the imagery.
Absolutely. Well, we could talk, for instance, about the French title of the film is not Blue is the Warmest Colour. It's actually La Vie d'Adèle, which is a reference to Marivaux, La Vie de Marianne. Which is a 17th century Marivaux text, which is about the human heart and what how we kind of unlock it and also how we keep ourselves protected, I suppose, from the kind of feelings that can be unleashed. And I think into the second half of the film, we realise that this relationship isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all between these two women. And then, in fact, it may not be as straightforward as just, you know, the Adèle character has realised that she's a lesbian. There's more to it than that. And also, he calls it La Vie d'Adèle chapitre et deux, one and two chapters. And I think that's an indication that the film is kind of a film of two halves, because we skip ahead in the middle. We know because Léa Seydoux's character suddenly is blonde rather than blue-haired. and this is when everything starts to change. For me, the second half of the film is maybe a little bit less intoxicating, but that's kind of on purpose. It's sort of a poignant come-down, I think.
Does it work? I mean, 3 hours is a lot to ask anybody.
It is. I think it really justifies that length because we really go through every kind of contour of this relationship. I wonder, in fact, if the much ballyhooed sex scenes are actually the really indulgent touch in the film. I mean, there's something kind of remarkable about watching them played out at that length. I wonder whether story-wise they necessarily are necessary. I mean, it's slightly dubious territory, and I think that a lot of feminist viewers, for instance, have said, you know, this is like a man's vision of the way that lesbians would have sex, and that this is sort of there's a male gaze going on here, that he's kind of too in love with these images.
It's very, very male gaze. I mean, yeah. I've spent 3 hours getting cramp because I got quite bored. I found it a very boring film, you know, I haven't clock watched so much in a film for a very, very long time. And I walked out and I thought, well, that was very dull and very boring. And the main character Adèle, I found constant close ups of a very, very blank face.
Well, he was obsessed
just wearing
with her lips.
Yes.
She's I love that actress, I must say. I kind of think that there's something really special about her, and every emotion is played out. For instance, we know that she's going to probably split up with this bloke at the beginning. We know things aren't quite right there. We don't need a single word in the script to tell us that. We just see her standing, looking a bit jittery outside the school one day, and we kind of know, oh, she's going to go and split up with him. And then we skip the scene of the breakup, and we just go to a close-up of the two of them after she's done it. And we kind of know everything that's taken place. We almost know every word that she's said to him because her acting is so expressive.
You get absolutely everything else. So you get her going to sleep. You get her having a cigarette. And I found it profoundly indulgent as a result. I found it about an hour and a half too long.
I can see that argument. And in fact, I know on The Guardian, someone commented, you know, well, if we really have to go and watch every single element of this sex scene playing out, why don't we show them going to the loo? I
mean, well, they practically did. And there's a big problem. I think a lot of people have found a big problem with the sex scenes, not because they're explicit. I mean, so what? I think the difficulty was is that it was very, very male gazy. I mean, it was almost like lesbian sex by numbers. You know, you just think, oh, are they going to do that? Oh, yes, they do. Are they going to do that? Oh, they've done that now. And after that, and with some, I found very, very clunky imagery. You talk about the motifs. Blue is the warmest colour. Things are all blue when
there's
it's
a lot
great.
Of blue. There's a lot
and
of
things
blue.
Aren't so blue when it's not so yeah. great. And, you know, there's
I quite like that, though. It's
you
like,
didn't
you
mind
know,
it.
When you have three colours blue, three colours red, three colours yeah. white. I quite like when there's something, especially because this is cinema and it's the paintbrush, the colours the paintbrush a director has to work with to create other layers to his story. Mm. So I quite like seeing, you know, her blue hair go from blue to blonde as she matures and becomes a fully grown exhibiting artist. And you see the flashes of blue, and they do have different meaning that even if you're not conscious of it, they're creating some kind of effect that I find you think of when you leave the cinema.
Yes.
That's a good thing for me yeah. always.
There were some profoundly clunky moments. I mean, you're talking about the moment when she realises that she wants to her sexuality awakens when she sees the girl with the blue hair. It happens on a crossroads. I mean, please. And then it was that just appalling moment where they're discussing, they're sort of skirting, the couple are discussing the idea of oral sex. And she says, and the main character says, I don't like oysters. And then, of course, the girls sleep together. And lo and behold, she's eating oysters.
I
like
think
there's
the
no
oyster
tomorrow.
Eating scene
and
is a bit dubious. Yeah,
so
it's like
clumsy.
It comes too soon after she's been learning everything about, you know, how it works with a woman in bed. And then suddenly, 10 minutes later, she is being shown every detail of how you eat an oyster.
Yeah.
That's a little bit much. I agree with you. I think there are moments where the film pushes it. But I still think, and in fact, I came down a step from some of the kind of ecstatic raves that the film received in Cannes. I didn't see it there. I just saw it last week. And I think people went a little bit overboard, but I still think actually it's kind of a remarkable and ambitious piece of work. It's pushing a lot of buttons. It's pushing them a few of them a bit too hard.
I have to say my favourite part, no one really talks about it, is the whole theme of education and learning. And, you know, she starts in a classroom and then she becomes a teacher. And then the most joyous parts of the film were the little children she teaches. And I thought that was the part of the joy of the film to me.
What I love is the fact that we don't really sense that she's grown all that much. It's almost like she's this sort of kid in school and then suddenly she's a kid teaching in school. And there hasn't been this kind of radical transition. And that's the way it plays out
she
in life.
She just puts on glasses.
We just stumble into whatever we're doing. And, you know, there is no sort of now I've reached adulthood, I can take a job. You know, there's none of that.
That is Blue is the Warmest Colour, widely released now. Go and take a comfortable cushion. That's all we can say. Tim, let's move on to Saving Mr. Banks, Emma Thompson and Tom Hanks. What are your thoughts on this? What's the premise of this film?
So this is about the making of Mary Poppins. It's about how Walt Disney in 1953-4 persuaded P.L. Travers, the author of the Mary Poppins books, to have them desecrated, as she saw it, and turned into a massive mainstream musical film. Tom Hanks plays Walt Disney, but the main role is Emma Thompson's as P.L. Travers, and she has to sort of deal with every part of the kind of Hollywood process. She arrives in L.A. and arrives in her hotel room to find Goofy and Mickey Mouse and puppets and teddies and everything stuffed in every corner of her room. And she has to kind of banish them into the wardrobe because she's a very uptight Brit
She's very sensible in my eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
The real story is a real story. It is fascinating. I mean, just as the whole story, how she was so not Mary Poppins. But do they, because it's a Hollywood film, does it get a bit cheesy, the kind of playing up those comic elements?
It does a little bit. I mean, the kind of fish out of water stuff, though it's very funny and Emma Thompson can kind of play that very funnily. I think it's there's a certain kind of slightly cheesy and sentimentalized Hollywood glow to it. I particularly found it a problem that Walt Disney has to sort of explain to her what her book's about. And we get these flashbacks, which are the worst section of the film, which is about her upbringing in Australia. And Colin Farrell plays her kind of drunken, tragic father and is very miscast. At first, he's trying to do a kind of Johnny Depp in Finding Neverland routine, where he's kind of this sort of floppy charm. And then he starts drinking, and then he's doing a kind of Oliver Reed routine. And neither one of them quite works.
Let's have a listen.
20 years ago, I made a promise to my daughters that I would make your Mary Poppins fly off the pages of your books. I promised them, Pam.
I know what he's going to do to her. She'll be cavorting and twinkling.
You can't make the film unless you grant the rights.
Damn.
Now, let us begin.
From here.
She has a lot of ideas.
What kind of ideas?
Constables responsible. Now, how does that sound?
No. Responsible is not a word.
We made it up.
Well, unmake it up.
Saving Mr. Banks there with Emma Thompson, Tom Hanks, Colin Farrell. Tim, it's like a sort of an A-level, well, a sort of an age 18 film review program today. We have the male gaze in Blue is the Warmest Colour, and then we have this great thing of intertextuality. We're talking about filmmaking in film. How successful is it in this?
It's not bad, you know, up to a point. All the stuff with Emma Thompson in Hollywood trying to deal with everything that's happening to her beloved book works. At the end of that trailer, we had a moment where they said, she says, unmake it up. That's not a word. And we see the Sherman brothers who wrote the lyrics at that point hiding behind the piano the fact that they've got super califragilisticexpialidocious written down on the next sheet. You know, there's little jokes like that which are really good. And I think anyone who's a fan of Mary Poppins, as I am, I think it's the great, maybe the great musical of that era in Hollywood, is going to really enjoy the way the songs are kind of reach their fruition in this story, and kind of the way the Sherman brothers figure out how to tell the story musically and to also please her, because that's the key thing. They have to keep her happy.
The interesting thing is the first thing when you read about this film is it you go back to YouTube to find clips from the original Mary Poppins. It is so dated now, but so amazing. What is it about Mary Poppins, no matter how dated it seems, that it just is still such a classic?
It's strange. It is. It just exudes charm, that film, even when it's doing terrible wrong things like Dick Van Dyke. It is still. It does endure, and I think there's a strange alchemy to it. It's almost as if the Disney sentimentality and the P.L. Travers sort of sternness created a strange fusion that actually works really well, and the emotions in it are quite repressed through most of the film. And then Mr. Banks himself at the end, when he kind of does his glorious gesture with fixing the kite, it really unleashes it. And that's also a great climax in the film, I think. The kind of let's fly a kite scene is the scene where P.L. Travers really is won over to the idea of this adaptation.
And that is Saving Mr. Banks, which is out in the next couple of weeks, wherever you are in the world. And also Blue is the Warmest Colour, out now. Tim Robey, thank you as ever for joining us on The Review. We head to Jerusalem next, so stay tuned.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
It's time now to get the critics' perspective from a city around the world. And today we're off to Jerusalem to get the opinion of Jessica Steinberg, cultural journalist for The Times of Israel. She spoke to Marika Peters.
There's always really a lot happening at the Israel Museum, being one of our major cultural institutions. Right now, they've got this very cool exhibit that is called Aircraft Carrier, American Ideas and Israeli Architectures. It's looking at the history of Israeli-American relations, but particularly on how American ideas have influenced Israeli society and its architecture. And that's going on, you know, through the winter. Another nice thing that's happening there is this event in several nights in November, which is Opera in the Galleries. They're bringing in opera and some Beatles, basically musicians and opera singers wandering through various galleries of the museum.
Oh, wow, that sounds cool. And singing and performing, that kind of thing?
Singing and performing. You do have to get tickets, very limited number. But it's a new thing and promises to be sort of another cool element in Jerusalem.
For anybody who wants their culture a bit more street-based, what have you got for them?
Right. So if you just want to go hang out and maybe take in some culture along the way, head to the first station in Jerusalem. That's our refurbished train station that opened over the summer. And beyond just, you know, shopping, getting food, or funky Israeli designs and having a beer while you do that, or a coffee, you can stop in once a week for Sects in the City. That's S-E-C-T-S. A look at the more hidden religious sects in Jerusalem, and introduced and lectured by a local anthropologist.
And when you say sects, you're not talking just about the different three monotheistic religions based here. You're talking about small subsects. Like, give me an example, maybe.
Oh, I think we're probably looking at Coptic, maybe something Syrian, probably maybe something related to the Druze, because we're all, so we always call it the secret sect, and we don't really know what it is, that kind of stuff.
Okay, this has all so far been in West Jerusalem. What about people looking to find their culture in the east part of the city?
Well, I always like to send people to the Rockefeller Museum, which is the East Jerusalem branch of the Israel Museum. It's a museum that does not get as much traffic at all. Although, in fact, last year, Manofim, which means cranes in English, which is sort of an introduction to the exhibitions of the year, opened last year in that branch, in the Rockefeller Museum, and they were showing a lot of different stuff, and there's been a continuation of that. So I like to send people there first.
Jessica Steinberg there from The Times of Israel. She was talking to Marijke Peters. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We head to South Korea next.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and today we're crossing to Seoul to unearth what's sparking the interest of review regular Bernie Cho.
Bernie's president of the DFSB Collective, a creative and music agency based in South Korea, and he's on the line now to give us the latest on what's happening in the Korean music scene. Bernie, a very warm welcome back to the review. What is on your radar?
Well, actually, although I was in Seoul, I really wished I was actually in Hong Kong this weekend. Mnet, the largest music video channel here in Korea, they had their annual Asian Music Awards show, and again, they held it at Hong Kong. And obviously, although a lot of Korean artists were featured and took home trophies, it really was a showcase for a lot of Asian artists, as well as a few international surprise guests like Stevie Wonder and even Paris Hilton was there.
So can you tell us some of the surprise winners at last night's awards?
Well, one of the surprise winners was actually a female artist who was basically embroiled in a huge internet scandal. And usually scandals will often derail an artist's career, but in this case, it actually might have inadvertently helped her not only gain momentum, but perhaps even pick up a trophy. That artist happens to be the Korean-American R&B songstress Ai Lee. She ended up taking home the trophy for Best Vocal Performance Female for her hit You and I. And it's kind of ironic that the track that she won for, You and I, actually was a bit ironic in the sense that an internet sort of nude photo scandal erupted a few days or about a week or so online, where supposedly one of her ex-boyfriends may have leaked those photos. And so You and I definitely had a very strange twist, because online it was definitely very much a he said, she said, at times bordering on the dramatic to even comic. But this scandal actually really got a lot of fans not only enraged, but really an outpouring of sympathy and support. And that actually drove her online voting to the point where it looked like she was going to become a dark horse winner to pick up one of the big trophies. And that's exactly what happened.
I mean, would the cynic in us say that perhaps this was a very well-timed problem for Ailee to have?
Well, it's one of these things, I think, in Korea, whenever a celebrity, male or female, runs into some sort of internet scandal, and especially, you know, if it happens to involve nudity, it's one of these things that management companies and artists just really don't know how to handle. It's one of these things that caught everybody off guard. And what ended up happening was, you know, instead of, you know, obviously there was talk of her sort of laying low and perhaps not performing and not appearing, I think the outpouring of support, not only in the media, but more importantly, her fans, really sort of pushed her and propelled her to really not only take the stage, but more importantly, to pick up the trophy with her head held up high. And so nowadays, you know, they always say, you know, sometimes bad publicity is good publicity. You know, in this particular case, it might have ended up being that way.
Well, let's hear a clip then of this this song that got her the trophy for best vocal performance. This is You and I. Ailee there, You and I, the track that got her best vocal performance at the Asian Music Awards in Hong Kong last night. That is the musical choice of Bernie Cho. Bernie, there's the best male solo, the man who sort of swept up last night was G-Dragon, wasn't it?
It was indeed. G-Dragon, who is on the same artist management / label of Psy, this year just took home pretty much every major trophy that was available and that he was up for. He took home Best Male Artist, Best Dance Performance for Male Solo, Best Music Video, and more importantly, Artist of the Year. And, you know, the album title, the single title, the music title was pretty apropos because it was called Coup d'Etat.
Well, let's have a listen. This is G-Dragon and Coup d'Etat. 시간이 돈이라면 난 상당히 빙고 일상의 오해 홍길동 신고 내 폰은 계속 울어대가 나에만 해 내 폰은 계속 지저대 그 지역에만 해 와와와 예쁘여 예쁘게 자폭해 허세 got 아주 번번해 I'm so fresh so clean 세탁소란 경쟁이 That was Coup d'Etat from G-Dragon. And I mean, K-pop and Korean artists are getting more and more popular outside of Korea. And I think this is really reflected in South by Southwest choice this year. Can you tell us a little bit about the excitement with the new announcement of how many bands are going to Austin, Texas this year?
Yeah, what's really interesting is although it's you know 2013 is wrapping up, people are already looking forward to 2014. And for a lot of Korean music acts, particularly those in the rock, the urban, and the electronic genres, the big event they look forward to every year now is South by Southwest. Now, only 5 years ago, there was only one Korean artist that performed there, and now this year, over 50 acts apparently applied. And what was more impressive is that there was a record number of Korean artists who've been accepted and have been announced to perform next year at South by Southwest. And what made it, I think, all the more special was one of the big U.S. music magazines, Spin Magazine, cited a dozen Korean acts as bands to check out next year in 2014. Among some of the acts that were listed as must-see were the electronic act Idiotape, as well as sort of a hardcore rock thrash band called Hollow Jan. And then they actually had a section called Safe Bets with an artist called Big Phony, as well as Glenn Check. And there were some Go Rogue acts that they highly recommended to check out, namely Crying Nut, No Brain, Galaxy Express, Love X Stereo, Rock and Roll Radio, Jambonai, Kia and the Faces, and last but not least, YB.
The names just get better each time you come on the program, Bernie. Thank you very much indeed. I'm particularly interested in Crying Nut. You mentioned there YB, one of the first ever to go to South by Southwest.
Yeah, he years ago performed at South by Southwest all by himself in front of very few people. And I think although he was a pioneer, I think he was a little bit ahead of his time because it was a moment where people were like, Korean rock? What is that? And, you know, to his credit, he's been very much a mentor to a lot of indie bands and rock bands in particular. And largely because of sort of the trail that he blazed, follow-up years, you see more and more Korean rock bands going to South by Southwest. So for him, it's a bit of a homecoming, if not a comeback stage for him. It's the fifth anniversary of his first, really, it's the first Korean act appearance at South By. But this year, he's going to be joined by not only many of his peers, but many of his indie rock colleagues as well. So it's quite exciting.
Well, we have YB at the ready on our Monocle Review turntable. Here is A Flying Butterfly.
The Flying Butterfly there by YB. Bernie Cho, you mentioned quite a few people who are going to be heading to South by Southwest. One of them, regular listeners to Monocle 24 will know that Glenn Check makes quite an appearance, quite often too. He's on his way to South by Southwest. What difference will this make for his career?
For Glenn Check or for YB?
Well, for either, really.
Okay. Well, I think one of the interesting things is that, as you noted, YB, you know, has a little bit of an electronic flair to their new rock sound. And what's really interesting is the 2013 Korean Music Awards winner for Best Electronic Album. That band, Glenn Check, has also been tapped to not only be the headliner for the 2014 Seoul Sonic Tour, but more importantly, they're also going to South by Southwest to promote a double album they just released worldwide this week called Youth. And as if things couldn't get any better for the band, they're also slated to go to L.A. in January to jump into the recording studios with the legendary YouTube producer Steve Lillywhite.
That's quite amazing. I never thought that Steve Lillywhite would suddenly jump into K-pop. Is this then, Bernie, a complete example of total crossover then?
Well, what's really interesting is that you're starting to see a lot of Korean acts obviously not only performing overseas, but also performing more comfortably in English and doing more of their interviews in English. And so you're starting to find, and more importantly, hear and see a lot of artists becoming very comfortable, similar to, I think, many European artists, in terms of incorporating English not only to their live sets, but more importantly to their interviews. And there seems to be a bit more confidence in terms of Korean acts, you know, basically hitting the stage, playing in front of anywhere between 5,000 to 50,000, and, you know, who knows, even upwards of 50,000 people.
Well, let's have a listen to a track from Glenn Check's new album. This is Pacific.
Check there on Monocle 24, the choice of today's music reviewer, Bernie Cho from the DFSB Collective. Bernie, K-Rookie, what's that then?
This is great. This is sort of one of these battle royales that the Korean government is kind enough to fund every year. The Ministry of Culture, they actually have an annual Battle of the Bands competition called K-Rookies, where every month the hottest, newest indie bands go head-to-head for a chance to not only win prize money, but more importantly, TV appearances, festival gigs, and industry buzz and momentum. And what's been very interesting, and we've been following very closely, is after a year of really excellent bands going after each other, one band emerged victorious, and I think they have probably one of the best names I've seen in years, because there's definitely truth in advertising. They're just simply called Rock and Roll Radio. And the critics absolutely love them. And again, they've not only been tapped for the 2014 Seoul Sonic Tour, but more importantly for South by Southwest next year as well. And their new album, which just came out this month, the title's perfect. It's just literally called Shut Up and Dance. And their new single from that same album is called Shut Up and Dance.
Bernie Cho, thanks so much for joining us from Seoul. And we're going to end our music review with the sound of Shut Up and Dance from Rock and Roll Radio.
Rock and Roll Radio with Shut Up and Dance, ending this week's music review with our friend from the DFSB Collective in Seoul, Bernie Cho. I was delighted, Gillian, to see that they have a government-sponsored battle of the bands each year. I think that's amazing. That's a fresh democracy if ever there was
Love
one.
It.
Time now to offer a helping hand to our listeners finding themselves at a loose end in the corner of the world. Today, dear listener, take heart if you're in Mexico City.
Because that's where our New York Bureau Chief, Santiago Tarditi, is. And here's his guide to what you could be getting up to this weekend.
Mexico City is buzzing throughout the 7 days of the week, but it's the weekend when the capital really gets going. From cultural plans to late-night jams, there's something for everyone. Kick off with some good literature shopping. Take a cab to the Roma neighborhood and visit the Casa Bosques bookstore. A shop stocked with the best magazines and books from independent publishers from around the world. Check out the latest issues of titles such as Fantastic Man, Purple Fashion, Apartamento, and of course, Monocle. Enough enlightenment for now, it's time to have fun. Book a table at the popular Maximo restaurant, run by the famed chef Eduardo Lalo Garcia, and try a high-end version of the local cuisine. The menu changes daily, but his grilled octopus has become a recurrent feature on his Saturday selection. Just in case you don't manage to secure a reservation at the Maximo, worry not. His latest venture, the Puebla restaurant, will be opening very soon. Before the weekend is over, don't forget to shake your skeleton to the rhythm of Mexican tunes. Although we're fans of mariachi music, we highly recommend you hit the deck at the MN Roy, the best club in town. Wear comfortable sneakers because here the party goes on until sunrise. This Saturday, half Swedish, half Mexican DJ Alex Diaz Anderson will be behind the spinning tables. If you're still craving a culture fix after so much partying, check out the newly opened Jumex Museum on Sunday. The art center, located in the upscale Polanco neighborhood, houses the largest private collection in Latin America, owned by Eugenio López Alonso. The new museum was built by British architect David Chipperfield, who is also behind the Tate Modern Museum in London. A good balance of modern art pieces by international artists, from Damien Hirst to Damian Ortega, are exhibited across three floors, courtesy of curator Patrick Sharpnell. For Monocle in Mexico, I'm Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi.
Always good to hear a little bit of mariachi. On the review here on Monocle 24, we'll be back in a moment with a look ahead to this season's best television.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to The Review. Now, times are a-changing. TV series are no longer Cinderella to cinema, at least not the well-made ones. Some of the most talked about and rewarding dramas these days are brought to you courtesy of web-based finance and faith.
And refreshingly, in the last few years, viewers have embraced drama in a variety of languages. After French, Italian, and of course the brilliant offerings in Danish, I'm talking Borgen and Swedish, The Killing, will be clinging on to the subtitles of a new drama in Polish to tell us more. And of course, to trawl through some of the Globe's other big TV offerings, I'm delighted to say Stuart Clark, the editor of TBI, Television Business International, joins us live in the studio. Welcome to The Review, Stuart.
Thanks for having me.
We wanted to start with The Pack. This is this Polish drama. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so The Pack is in production at the moment, actually. So we'll see it next year, or people in Poland and throughout Central Europe will first. So it's a Polish drama series. And it's notable because what we're seeing now is HBO Europe making its own original productions instead of just having what's come from the US, which, of course, is fantastic. You know, it's the Boardwalk Empires. We're talking about, you know, that kind of signature show, fantastic quality stuff. But they're starting to kind of really hit their stride in terms of original programming. And what we have with The Pack is it's something, a six-part drama set on the Polish-Ukrainian border about a pack of border guards, effectively, who kind of a mysterious tragedy befalls them. And it's kind of got a lot of this sort of the HBO signature, you know, dark edginess, incredible writing and so forth. And as I say, it's notable for being the first thing that's being done in Polish and will play elsewhere in the world thereafter.
Does this series is being shot in Poland, and of course Poland has an amazing history of cinematography and filmmaking. Does it benefit from the cinema expertise?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer is yes, it does. As you say, there's a real tradition of filmmaking. However, in terms of making this type of TV series, this is a first, but the infrastructure is there. So the writers are there. There's a growing pool of writers for TV. And in terms of kind of the technical infrastructure, all the pieces are in place. So I think this will look fantastic. And because it's HBO, will look quite filmic. And actually, this builds upon something they did in the Czech Republic last year called Burning Bush. And I think that gave them a lot of confidence to do more. And that was about Jan Palach, the student who set himself on fire in Wenceslas Square in the late 60s. So that kind of had a very kind of political, social consciousness angle, whereas I think this is more out-and-out thriller entertainment.
It's a sort of a strange turning on its head of the way that things have been in the last couple of years. Namely, great drama has been made in Sweden, in Denmark, in France, and has subsequently been bought. This is now the Americans perhaps trying to get a slice of that European pie on a reasonable budget, because I can imagine that filming costs in Poland aren't as expensive as other places, and also trying to buy into the whole very cool element of it all.
Yes, I think that's fair. However, you know, HBO does already have that kind of cachet and that cool brand in the States and is already established in Europe, and this is them moving into original programming. That's kind of the interesting thing about The Pack, I think. And yeah, as you say, this then creates something that can be sold around the world. You know, it's a piece of intellectual property that they will seek to make money from, yeah.
And the brilliant thing is HBO Europe, I gather, is based in Budapest. And if you think of that part of the world, the former Soviet Union, the Eastern Europe on their doorstep, it's so rich with stories.
There were some incredible stories. I mean, Burning Bush was a great example of a story that resonated very strongly throughout the region. And in terms of The Pack, I think the place that it's shot, I think that's very important. This is that border part is very filmic in terms of it lends itself to some, you know, some beautiful cinematography or, you know, TV filming and such like. So In that sense, the place is very important in this case. With Burning Bush, it was more about a story that was very important to people in the region.
Let's move on to a series which is pioneering in very different ways. Alpha House, the first offering from Amazon, trying to jump into the Netflix love film game. It's a little bit like The West Wing, except it's the other side.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. It's about four Republican senators who for various reasons all live together in one house. So, you know, it's a nice setup. John Goodman is, you know, it should be an ensemble cast. I'm not sure if that's possible when you've got John Goodman there. You know, he's a big character. He dominates the screen.
Yes.
He kind of, you know, sucks up all of the air, I think, but in a good way.
It reminds me of The House and Big Brother. It sounds rather surreal.
Let's have a little listen to it.
Winning is what we do. We're the GOP.
Are you getting all this down?
Yes, sir.
Why? Listen, are you still looking for a place to live?
I am. You joining us? If I can have the upstairs room.
Well, it is a little unusual that you don't campaign.
Why should I?
Son of a bitch!
Who smashes an iPhone?
I
I've been backing him for years.
Yes, and I've been fronting for her. Who knew?
You never handled a gun in your life, have you? How did you miss that?
John Goodman, guns and the GOP. What is there not to love about this?
Yeah, and the really interesting thing about this show is how it came about, because Amazon ordered a ton of pilots, and in the same way you review books on Amazon and give them a star rating and can leave comments, they did that with their pilots. So they kind of put it out there to the people who log onto the site, and particularly their subscribers, their Prime subscribers. And kind of through process of elimination, it wasn't quite as simple as the one that got the most votes got made. However, you know, there was an element of that. They're kind of crowdsourcing which pilot was the most popular. And this was one of the kind of the first batch, and is their first original show. And it launched in the States last week. I think the fourth episode went out yesterday. And yeah, this is clearly them taking on Netflix with original shows.
It's so exciting for filmmakers now. Are people with stories to tell? Because it used to just be you were beholden to the big major studios for finance. And now if you have a story in you, there's so many alternative ways to get your story made.
That's right. And Amazon being a great example of that, because not only can production companies and people who've got, you know, a history of making TV or film put something forward to them, anyone can. You can submit a script to them, and it goes into this, you know, the mixer effectively. A pilot could get made. People vote on it. So it's a very, you know, democratic process. And as you say, a new opportunity for creative people, certainly.
Let's take a look at a new series that's in production at the moment. A 3D documentary series, which at first glance strikes me as horror, but then you realise what it's about and you think, actually, this could be a very sensible thing.
That's Cathedrals of Culture.
It is.
Yeah, that's, I mean, as kind of the documentary channels and lots of kind of factual production moves more towards the kind of the reality end, this is a straight up classic bit of factual TV. So what it is it's a 3D show. Wim Wenders led the project. His production company is making it. And in each episode, you have a filmmaker from around the world. It's a really nice international mix. Looking at a particular building, talking about, you know, its history and their personal relationship to it, but also looking, using that as a prism to look at the wider culture. So Wim Wenders looks at the Berlin Philharmonic, I think, and then we've got Danish director Michael Madsen, who made Into Eternity, and I think he's looking at the Halden Prison in Norway. It's a really diverse mix. And then Robert Redford came to it as well, and he's looking at the Salk Institute, the biotech institute in the States, and he's directing it and putting it together. So yeah, potentially really interesting show.
I'm so excited by this. Like, the 3D in Gravity left me cold, but the thought of architecture in 3D I find absolutely thrilling. And especially, I think architecture has been quite underserved in television. There aren't many television programs about architecture, and yet again they're just so full of stories that resonate.
I mean, the truth is that most people will watch it in 2D because not that many people have access to 3D television. But you're completely right that this really lends itself to that form. It's not kind of shoehorning something into 3D. This naturally works. There's also the other interesting thing about this show is that one of the production partners is a company or is a TV channel called Wow Wow from Japan. Now, Japan is a very insular TV market, produce lots of fantastic shows, but rarely get involved in international shows in this way. So the fact they're investing means that they will have an editorial voice, and it's just very unusual for there to be a Japanese partner on something like this, and may also lend an interesting angle.
There is a big crossover element that adds a very bankable aspect to this, which is the fact that you have the likes of Wim Wenders and Robert Redford, who are bringing that cinematography and that fiction film element to television. And we're just seeing this the whole time, aren't we? We saw this with the James Campion drama a few months ago.
We're seeing it, you know, I'd write about international TV day in, day out, and every day you're seeing major film stars coming to the small screen. Mm-hmm. I think with something like this, effectively, if, you know, Wim Wenders is leading it, so initially you're going to have that interest, and then if you go to, you know, a notable director and ask them, you know, what building they're passionate about, then, you know, in a sense, these are six passion projects.
Finally, let's talk about Klondike, Discovery Channel's first drama series. We're all mission. This is a mashup, ladies and gentlemen. Let's have a listen.
You're looking at a rich man. I wasn't that once. The Yukon is 4,650 miles. I had nothing in my pocket, but a head full of hope.
A fair number of men are gonna walk out of here rich, but only a handful are gonna be remembered.
This place kills.
You should really walk away. The second we staked our claim, we were marked men.
A clip of Klondike, Discovery Channel's first series. Stuart, we have a little under a minute to explain what is this all about and why we should be excited.
Okay, let's go quick. So it's based on the Charlotte Gray novel, Gold Diggers. It's Discovery's first move into drama. It's got a great cast. There's Sam Shepard, Richard Madden from Game of Thrones. It's made by Ridley Scott's production company, which is obviously means that we're going to get something visually spectacular. The fact it's for Discovery means that you might expect there to be a level of, you know, historical accuracy there that there wouldn't be with another drama. And it's big budget, shiny TV.
What's there not to love about a bit of big budget, shiny TV? We were going to talk about a reality television programme involving men shooting ducks.
Duck Dynasty, yeah. Now this is...
but sadly, we don't have time. Okay. Isn't that a shame, hey? Look it up, ladies and gentlemen, if you want about 30 seconds of jaw-dropping, well, whatever. Stuart Clark, editor of Television Business International, thank you very much for your time for joining us here on The Review.
Thanks.
And with that, we must bring a close to our weekly review show. So it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilbao and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And thanks to our studio manager too, Claire Urban.
Next week on The Review, we look forward to welcoming back to the studio Norwegian-born, London-based music producer Mathis Wiss as one of our special guests. But for now, get ready for The Curator, Monocle's best of radio show, which pulls together the unmissable highlights from the week that was here on Monocle 24.
But for now, from me, Emma Nelson
and Gillian Tobias,
it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.